meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news. Broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Tonight, I thought I would put together a fantastic legal panel and talk about some of the high-profile cases that are in the news today. We have L.A. County Deputy District Attorney Robin Sachs and L.A. high-profile defense attorney. In fact, I think I saw it on the internet that he was super attorney or the captain attorney or something. I don't know, Mark Worksman. It's nice to have you both here. Good evening.
Good evening. Thank you for having
us. Mark, it's nice to have you on the show for the first time. Tell my audience a little bit about you.
I'm a criminal lawyer in Los Angeles. I have a six-lawyer firm, and all we do is criminal defense. I started my career as a deputy district attorney in the late 1980s. I was in the same office that Robin is now a deputy district attorney in. And from there, I went to the United States Attorney's Office, where I was an assistant United States attorney in the criminal division of the United States Attorney's Office in Los Angeles, prosecuting major crimes and also major narcotic crimes. And in 1992, I went into private practice, started the law office of Mark Worksman, and my practice is in downtown Los Angeles and represents clients throughout Southern California and other states on serious felony cases. Much of the work is in federal court, and many of the cases we do are involve financial crimes, but I also represent people in violent felonies as well. I have basically a general criminal practice.
We hear the deputy district attorneys going to become defense lawyers. Are we going to see that with Robin here in a few years?
I think Robin's being pulled in many directions.
I bet she is. You know, we can have... can you be a DA and a defense attorney at the same time? I don't think you can. Anyway, that's enough rambling from my part. Listen, I brought you guys on tonight, lady and gentlemen, to discuss some of the high-profile cases that we have going on in the media today. And I wanted to get the perspective both of a DA and a defense attorney. And as, you know, as taxpayers in public, because DAs and defense attorneys are John Q. citizens too, and I'm sure you have your own thoughts. And one of the most disgusting cases that I've heard about in a long time is this Edwin Ramos case, Mark. This is a El Salvadorian illegal immigrant into San Francisco who has a rap sheet as long as my arm, who, as we know, San Francisco is a sanctuary city, had been convicted and here allegedly shot a family, a father and two sons, the Bologna family. This is a tragic turn, but it's something that we keep hearing about, and I'm curious in your thoughts.
Who are you starting with?
Starting with Mark.
Well, then I have to tell you that it is shocking that the Sanctuary City movement has been perverted, I think, from an original goal, which was to allow crime victims and witnesses who may be illegal come forward and cooperate with the police and the prosecution of criminals without fear that they themselves might be deported if they called 911 to report a crime in progress.
Exactly.
What happened now is that the Sanctuary City movement has been turned on its head. And instead of protecting victims and witnesses from deportation, we're protecting violent predators and criminals from deportation. And so you correctly said, Dana, that in addition to being a criminal lawyer and Robin being a prosecutor, I also live in a community that is a sanctuary city.
Right.
And I find it very troubling. I don't think this is what the sanctuary movement ever meant to happen. And your outrage is justified. And I think that this whole movement has to be reconsidered and has to be changed.
Deputy District Attorney Robin Sachs. Gavin Newsom shouldn't be able to sleep well at night, although I'm picking on him as an individual, but there's the chief of police. There's all sorts of people in San Francisco that should take some blame here. But from the prosecution perspective, and I think Mark said it well, this isn't what sanctuary cities and being able to come in and report a crime is all about. This is what's happening is it's just protection for those illegals that are roaming wild and they're not getting sent back. And even when they do get reported to ICE, that doesn't always happen. What's going on here is, can you not walk the streets in San Francisco safely at night?
Well, San Francisco has a reputation of being one of the more liberally governed places. I guess if I were a criminal, maybe San Francisco would be the place I would move to, knowing that they don't prosecute all that much. And if they do, they're pretty lenient over there. However, it's interesting. I think Mark brings up some excellent points in that not only do you have the whole citizen aspect, but also, and I kind of look at the flip side, is there are a lot of good reasons why entry into this country is something that people should support for, you know, having being able to tie into the workforce. And there could be a lot of really good arguments that why we may want to extend some of our immigration rights. However, when you have one case like this, where there's so much loss of life, and then where our own government fails to protect our own people, all of a sudden you start to question, and the easiest thing to do is then attack the underlying issue of immigration. But I think that there is a problem within the immigration process and the international cooperation, but there's also just a problem in law enforcement in general to let to fail to kind of keep anyone informed and a failure to do anything in this case.
Mark, when you look at these sorts of cases, and as tragic as they are, I'm going to ask you to put your defense attorney hat on now. Ramos is going to be very difficult for him to be able to get a trial that's not swamped with media coverage, that's not swamped with all sorts of negativity towards him. I believe in the doctrine of innocent until proven guilty, too. But bottom line, this individual shouldn't have been walking the streets of San Francisco.
No, I do agree with you, and I'd like to ask, where have the DAs and the judges been in this debate? Right now, today, Gavin Newsom is an easy punching bag, but he's just one mayor. I'd like to know where the judges and DAs have been. They take guys like Ramos, they give them plea bargains and allow them to get probation, and judges will say, well, see you later, and they let these guys walk out of their courtroom, so ravage the community. So I'm curious to know why DAs and judges haven't been at the forefront of contacting ICE, we called it INS, now we call it ICE,
right,
deportation of these violent offenders whom they process. They see them and they know all the facts of the cases, and then they give them probation or short sentences and send them back out.
We're quick to pick on the DAs here a little bit, Robin. Is this something because the system is just so plugged, it is so busy, that it's a quick way to get through the trial, get through the case, get on the docket, get to another one, that maybe some of these are slipping through the cracks, sanctuary city or not?
Well, it's kind of it's interesting because I think, and I don't want to attack Mark because this is his first time on the show. However, I would have a hard time believing that if I offered a client of his probation on some of the cases that Ramos had, he wouldn't jump at the opportunity for probation. So, it's part of, I guess, my point that I'm trying to bring up is that we all have our own personal views in terms of our own personal safety and how our society should live. But then we also have the realities of the criminal justice system. And the reality of the criminal justice system is that the criminal defense attorney's job is to get the best possible disposition for their client, while the prosecution's best job is to secure a conviction. And sometimes the best way to secure a conviction is by plea bargain, because frankly, some of our cases that we file stink, and Mark can vouch for that.
If you're just tuning in, L.A. County Deputy District Attorney Robin Sachs and L.A. Defense Attorney Mark Worksman are here. And I thought I'd bring in the legal panel tonight and talk about some of the high-profile cases that we're hearing in the news. Mark, I'm not sure if you know or not. My show goes out across North America, worldwide, on the Internet and satellite. But I'm in Canada, and one thing that Canadians aren't eligible to do is they're not eligible to get a green card from the United States unless we're sponsored through family or through employment. So these green card lotteries that you hear all the time, believe it or not, that your closest neighbor, Canada, is not eligible to be part of. So when you see people trying to get in to the United States legally through the front door, yet you hear about all these cases and all the politicians talking about illegal immigration, rights for immigrants, medical care for immigrants, and then all these tragic stories, it makes one wonder about this whole immigration system. And the United States altogether is broken. It needs to be fixed. How can we do that?
Well, I tend to agree with you. I think the immigration system is perverted, because what happens in the United States is we impose almost insurmountable barriers to educated, productive, high net worth individuals coming here to grow our economy, add to the workforce, and contribute. And we bar them with ridiculously low quotas, 7 to 10 year wait for legalization. But at the same time, we have almost zero enforcement to prevent tens of millions of illegals coming in, who tend to be sometimes the least productive,
right,
offer the least to our success, bring crime and drugs and gangs. So I'm not an expert in immigration, but I happen to live in Southern California, and in the criminal justice system that I've been a part of for 22 years, you know, we have a huge number of immigrants passed through, legal and otherwise. And I can see for myself that the immigration system that we have now, the laws are arbitrary, they're outmoded, and they definitely need to be fixed.
Robin,
I agree. If I were a Canadian, I would be outraged how difficult it is to come and work or live in the United States when you know that tens of millions of people who really shouldn't be here easily slip through a porous southern border.
I live 25 minutes from the United States border, and in order to get my daughter into the United States to go to school, to become a teacher, it was unbelievable the hurdles and the hoops that you had to jump through. And even then, she's not allowed to work while she's studying. She's only allowed to be in the United States for so long, has to come back and then go back again. It's absolutely crazy. But Robin, when it comes to this and this whole issue, and I've had the Minutemen on this program, we've talked immigration over the years many, 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 many times. But do we see a need for the, I'm sure you've heard of Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Maricopa County, who basically says, I don't care, I'm going out, I'm going to enforce the law like I've been sworn to do. Do we need more of that rather than the police chiefs and the mayors and the others that are basically thumbing their nose at federal law?
Yes. In short, is the answer. But the issue is twofold. One is there's the enforcing the laws and making sure there's the deportation. But on the other end, it's also stepping up the borders for the reentry, because that's what the biggest problem is.
Mm-hmm.
It's just as easy for the illegal alien criminal to return and commit crimes and then go back and come back once again. And that's what happens. And so when you talk about your daughter and the difficulty, it kind of, you know, it corroborates my view that it pays to be a criminal. It's a lot easier to do it that way, it seems, at times, than to go through the actual, machinations in terms of following the law.
Well, she's 3 years in the United States. I don't think she'll come back. She loves it. She wants to continue working there. But it just seems so unfair. Mark, when you see cases like this, and we're going to switch topics here in just a few minutes, but when you see cases like the Ramos case, and you see Geraldo, and you see Bill O'Reilly, and you see Nancy Gray, and you see all the pundits and all the news people talking about it and attacking this system and doing what they can to discredit the alleged accused, and then you get hired as a defense attorney. It doesn't necessarily mean this case, but any case. It's got to be so difficult for you. How do you do it? Because, again, like I said before, you're human too, and you have your own thoughts on this.
Well, it can be difficult. I've had cases where I've represented people who were just reviled and hated by the public for the despicable acts they allegedly committed. And as a criminal defense attorney, you really have to be true to the principles of your job, and you can't allow your emotion or your own passions or prejudices to enter into the way you think of the case. The role of the criminal defense attorney is enshrined in the Constitution. We have a duty to go in and evaluate the evidence, advise our clients, and steer them through what is probably the most difficult process they'll ever be encountering in their lives, and do so as an officer of the court, and test the prosecution's evidence, and make sure that the results, whatever they are obtained in a very fair, appropriate, and reasonable process. So I intellectualize it. I also believe that the role of the defense attorney is critical, and I think Robin would join me in saying that it's essential that we have an aggressive defense bar that will put the people to their test and force them to present only admissible evidence that's properly gathered and only obtain convictions when the evidence warrants it, and that says that the punishment is just a crime. So I look at my role as being part of a larger system that requires me to do my best to protect the rights of my clients. And you really have to get to shut out the public hue and cry. Sometimes it's difficult. I've had people scream at me and spit at me, and I've gotten nasty emails and letters that where people vent at me because they're outraged by what my clients have allegedly done. But you really just have to develop a thick skin and soldier ahead, keeping in mind what your role is, what your job is.
Robin, you know, here we go again, and you and I have discussed this about other cases, but now I'm going to reverse the role, talking not as a defense attorney, but as a DA, seeing a case like this that's in the public so much. Is this a slam dunk for you once you take it to trial?
Well, I think it's a mistake. Are you asking me from the DA perspective?
Yes.
From the DA perspective, I don't ever like to view anything as a slam dunk, even if I'd like to, you know, secretly think of it as a slam dunk, because you still have to know that you're dealing with jurors, and you and I have talked about this before, and I've said this before, that our jurors are our voters and our drivers. There's a bunch of wingnuts out there. You have no idea what they're going to think, feel, be passionate about, and what they're going to admit to them as voir dire or not.
Uh-huh.
So we have to, you know, kind of couch that into the reality. Just because there is all this outrage, just because there is this record, doesn't mean that, A, it's going to be within the juror's knowledge, and doesn't mean that, you know, it's going to not affect one juror. And we know that in criminal cases, we need a unanimous verdict, and that means that we need 12 wing nuts to agree, which that can be tough and challenging, and it's not as easy in a day and age, especially in a city like San Francisco that really, really seems to err politically and socially every time in favor of, you know, not doing anything. But on the flip side of it, is this a case that I would, you know, welcome the challenge? Absolutely.
We have a technical term now, wing nuts, for prospective juror pool, but that's okay. I see exactly what you're saying, because, you know, we don't see so much of it now, but I hear it's going to be coming back with something called the Legal Edge Network. But the gavel-to-gavel coverage that we used to see on Court TV and others is going to return. Mark, what do you think?
If I may, just to comment on Robin's statement. And not to get away from the question you asked, is can Ramos get a fair trial? You know, I have a feeling that this guy is cooked.
Yeah.
But whenever he goes to trial, any jury, they're going to know this is the illegal alien who massacred a family. And I think it's going to be a tremendous challenge down the road for some judge, maybe inside San Francisco County, or maybe the venue will be changed to some other county. But the widespread media coverage is going to make it very difficult for this guy. And I don't have an answer to that. You know, it's, sometimes the case is so pervasively covered by the media, and the defendant is so widely hated that you're never going to find a cocoon jury of 12 people who've never heard of the case, and you just have to hope to be fair.
Yeah, and it's naive, I think.
A question, though, Mark, do you really think that it's going to be admissible that he is an illegal immigrant? Because I think that's precisely the issue, is that that wouldn't be in front of the jury.
Yes, I think it is inadmissible in court. What I'm saying is that any group of citizens a year, 2 years from now, when a jury's impaneled, they're going to remember this is the illegal alien. I'm speaking of impression that's in the community's mind. I think it's going to be hard to conceal from the jury. Somebody on that jury is going to remember this case in the news. They're going to Google it. They're going to see who he is. And I fear that even though a judge will probably try heroically to keep out his illegal immigrant status, everybody knows who this guy is, and I think it's going to be very, very difficult, if not impossible, for him to get a fair trial. But
that's
he's going to have to get a trial, and
right.
Sometimes there's just no solution to it.
Yeah, and that was my point with the gavel-to-gavel coverage. These networks seem to cherry-pick, and if this isn't a big story, I don't know what is. When you see the mother, the wife of the three that were killed, and her impassioned plea on television, I don't know any producer or director or booker anywhere on any network that wouldn't want to make that a big story. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back here in just a minute or two with my legal panel. L.A. County Deputy District Attorney Robin Sachs and Defense Attorney from Los Angeles, Mark Werksman. You're listening to the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. Once again, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, we're back. Tonight we have L.A. County Deputy District Attorney Robin Sachs and L.A. Defense Attorney Mark Werksman. I remind you to check out Mark's website at www.werksman.com, werksmanslaw.com. And what I thought I'd do is put my legal panel together and talk about some of the high-profile cases that are in the news today, and one of the saddest ones. And every time I look at this little girl's picture on the internet or on television, I see a little angel there, and I just wish that there would be some answers as to where she is. Is she alive? Is mom telling the truth? Is grandma telling the truth? And I get angry when I see some of the news coverage that I've seen here lately with some of the hosts interrogating grandma and trying to solve the case themselves, and there's professionals out there that should be doing it. Report on the facts, but when you start implicating and implying things against family members, they're going to shut up real fast and go against the media real fast. And then the story spins away from the important part, and I'm talking about Kaylee Anthony, the young girl down in Florida that's missing. And I thought we'd start with Mark Werksman. All of a sudden, now you have mom. I think she's been offered $500,000 bail and hasn't been able to come up with the money yet. She's she's saying one story and not saying the other, and all of a sudden the lawyer's on TV with Geraldo and the dog, the bounty hunter, and there's all kinds of crazy stuff going on, and there's cadaver dogs in the car and all that, but we're forgetting the focus on just where the heck's the little girl. Your thoughts on this case?
Well, we're in a fog because I think the mother has not been forthright or honest about where the little girl is. Apparently, the mother waited approximately 5 weeks to report her daughter missing, and she did so at the insistence of her own mother, the grandmother, who's been out speaking very aggressively, trying to generate public support for finding Kaylee. But it's mystifying why a mother of a two-year-old would not report her child missing for almost 5 weeks, and then we really don't have an explanation for where this girl went. I probably know as much as anybody, Dana, from reading what's in the newspapers and what's on the websites. The mother had said that her daughter was with some babysitter, but it turns out the babysitter may have been a fiction.
Yep.
And so we just don't know.
You know, when you see these sorts of cases, and of course this case has more unanswered questions than answered questions. It goes back to the Duckett case and with Nancy Grace and the mother who ended up committing suicide and the father, all that sort of stuff. It's just heartbreaking, Robin, but to have a case like this, when you know very well mom's not being forthright, that there's, you know, this just isn't right. 5 weeks, just like Mark said, so many unanswered questions. But again, and this just absolutely drives me crazy. I know for a fact, after covering the Jennifer Kessie case, the missing girl from Orlando and with her family, and I've done dozens of stories on it, some very competent police officers down there, very competent investigators. But do we need Geraldo on the air interrogating grandma on live TV as to this case? Is it really the role of the media to try and find the little girl, or is it just plain and simple sense, you know, they're trying to sensationalize this, you know, if it bleeds, it leads?
Well, you're asking a lot of different questions. One has to do with the media, and in some ways, you know, we have the media to thank to know about this, and was probably the force that helped get the mom into custody.
Yep.
To at least start an investigation, and had the media not been involved and taken an interest, we may not even be at a point where we would be looking for this girl as a national and perhaps international search. So in one way, it's, you know, it's kind of the blessing and the beast at the same time. And of course, I never, you know, like to try a case in the media, and I certainly, you know, I toe a tough line here, because I comment on a lot of cases and like commenting on a lot of cases, but the, you know, to the extent that he's interviewing key witnesses and procuring statements on behalf of law enforcement and for, you know, potentially tainting future juries, when it gets to that point, I really think that we're crossing the line, and it can only do damage in terms of an investigation.
You know, these cases are high profile, and like you say, without the media, this may not be where it is today, and I agree with that totally. But Mark, the role of the media, I go back to the Natalie Holloway case, the young Alabama teenager. I covered that case as much as anyone, and her dad and mom both told me several times on air that without the media, you know, the case would have long died a long time ago. Is that not a problem, really? Because media or not, a missing person is a missing person, and they should be respected just the same whether they're on TV with Geraldo or not.
I agree with you, but, and I understand that in the Holloway case, that the constant unremitting news coverage absolutely drove the investigation. And unfortunately, we still don't know what happened to Natalie Holloway.
Right.
But without the parents going on the press every night, and I think that they were on Greta Van Susteren literally nightly and other news shows pushing for results, that I think helped stimulate the Aruban police to action. It stimulated the U.S. law enforcement to push the Arubans. That was all, I think, very appropriate. I have a problem with this Kaylee case, with the coverage, not because the media, but because the grandmother, and I don't fault the media for covering what is a compelling story, which is a little girl's missing under very, very unusual, almost bizarre circumstances.
Yep.
I have a problem with the grandmother. Now, I happen to be a father of three children myself, and I can only approximate the anguish and the grief of a family over a missing two-year-old, but the grandmother is going on the news every night. I saw her last night on a couple of different cable shows, and she's excoriating the public to help her find her granddaughter. But the answer to her granddaughter's whereabouts is sitting in the county jail. It's her own daughter.
Yep.
And if the grandmother's not going to be straight with the American public about what Kaylee's own mother says happened and why the grandmother waited 5 weeks, if the grandmother didn't notice for 5 weeks that her daughter's two-year-old wasn't at the house. I'm troubled by the spectacle of a grandmother who could get more answers from going to talk to her own daughter than going on making a public spectacle every night of her grief and anguish. She's asking us to go look for her granddaughter, but it's her own daughter who knows where that girl is. So I have a little trouble with that, and I think there's a mutualism between the nighttime cable shows and these people like this grandmother, they need each other, and they fulfill a role in each other's lives.
Yeah.
But at the end, I sit back and I'm thinking, why is the grandmother urging me to go out and look for her granddaughter when the answer is right there in her own family?
Yeah, and now, Robin, we're seeing, not unlike the Peterson case with Stacy, we're getting reports that the little girl was seen boarding an airplane to Atlanta, I believe, is the latest press. We're going to probably have sightings all over the place. Of course, we all hope and pray that the little girl is alive and well, and that there is some answer to this sword-twisted story. But today, in a bail hearing, you get reports of police officers smelling decomposition in a car and cadaver dogs, and I will vouch for those police officers. Once you smell that smell, that is something that you'll never forget as long as you are alive. It's very, very noticeable. And you have someone in the jail, and of course the reports that were coming out, Robin, was that they were keeping her in to try and get her to talk, but you know that you've got this case pending. How do you handle this? Because you've got the media, you've got about 15 different angles going at one time. How do you handle this? How do you get her to talk?
Well, and this is exactly the problem with the media from the prosecution point of view, is here you have really, I mean, as descriptive of the smell of decomposition is, and undoubtedly it is, what do you have? We don't have any statement. We have a grandmother who is making pleas to locate the little girl. We know that she's missing, but we have, and we have all the, you know, tipsters and the people saying all of these things. We don't have any last known place. There's nothing that the prosecution can even file right now. And because of the media coverage, undoubtedly, you know, tons, you know, if not more, defense attorneys have gotten in contact with this woman, and if they've done their job, they've told her to shut up and, you know, invoke and don't say a thing. And if she doesn't say anything, then what do you have? So, I mean, that's the saddest part of this whole thing, is here, you're going to end up with, you know, the goal of getting some, you know, spotlight on this case and getting some, you know, clues. But then, because of the media, the whole thing is going to probably blow up and not have any of those statements in the end.
I love the quote from the Anthony family attorney. His name is slipping my mind here right now, where he tells Geraldo, for example, don't put my picture on TV, put the little girl's picture on TV. Yet it makes me scratch my head a little bit why he's even on there debating search techniques with Dog the Bounty Hunter and Geraldo when there's, you know, like his client probably does know what's happening. Mark, when you have cases like this, these high-profile type cases where there are answers. Obviously, you swear an oath as an attorney, and you have ethics and responsibilities and all that sort of stuff. It must just wear on you to see the attack coming your way, and there's really nothing you can do about it except kind of go with the flow.
Well, that's right. You can't control a news story, and you can't control the public's reaction to a crime. All you can do is maintain your dignity, and I think a good defense attorney really tries his or her case in the courtroom, not outside on the courthouse steps, because the press coverage and public reaction is fickle and impossible to calibrate. So I think really a professional would simply try to learn the facts, try to get answers, and try to work out either a defense or a plea agreement. But it rarely, I think, is a defense helped by the defense attorney trying to get out front of a story and trying to manipulate the press or trying to try his or her case in the public. It doesn't. I haven't seen it work. You can look at all those high-profile cases in the past 10 years, from O.J. to Scott Peterson, and I don't think that the efforts of the lawyers to control public opinion or to manipulate the media made a difference at all.
I think, and I'm going to speak for Robin here, but she might disagree with you on that statement. Robin?
I absolutely disagree. I think that, first of all, I mean, I think OJ is the classic example of the media helping, as much as I loathe talking about the case, I think, in OJ, it's the classic example of the media, assisting the process and raising the standard of proof. I think that you saw it in Phil Spector. I think you see it in Michael Jackson. I just think that whenever you have a case in the media and you're able to, a case that's in the media from the defense perspective, you're able to really try the case in advance, get a sense of public opinion. And I think that really the only person that gets hurt by cases in the media are the prosecution. And I, whenever I have a case, and I've told you this, Dana, before, is I don't like commenting on my own cases. I don't like talking about my own cases. The only time that is you really want to talk about your own case is if you've got someone on video and you've got someone copying out and it's just so good that, maybe under those circumstances you want to let people know that, we're not willy-nilly filing cases in the DA's office. We actually have corroboration and evidence. But generally, when defense attorneys and Mark is a classic example. If he were to be in front of the camera, he's a charming guy, he's a handsome guy, he's a well-spoken guy. People will connect and bond with that well before he ever gets into a courtroom, and they'll like him. And the fact of the matter is likability is a huge factor. Look at Hillary and Obama. People don't like her.
Yeah, well, I wonder if they don't like her or they don't like her husband, but either or, that's besides the point. Mark, I also disagree to a point as far as media and coverage. Joel Brodsky, who's been on this program many times, who represents Drew Peterson, has told me very openly right on this program on live air that he wants to get his client in the public as much as he can, because if there ever is a charge filed against him, he wants to make sure that the public knows all about Drew Peterson. But that can totally backfire on you, because that public may have a bad impression of your client, not unlike what happened with OJ.
Well, I'm still glowing from all the nice things Robin said about me. Dana, you're right. I think the more the public gets to know Drew Peterson, the more they're going to loathe him. So I don't know that it's that's an effective strategy. But the other cases that Robin spoke of, I believe, involved gag orders where the defense attorneys really say much or couldn't say much publicly. The story is going to run. The press is going to run it. They're going to explore different angles. They're going to sensationalize it. As a defense attorney, though, I don't know that there's much that you can do to control or develop that. And I think that the public has a dim view of the defense attorney, who appears to be playing to the press and trying to manipulate public sentiment. But look, it's you're right about the fact that sometimes the results are confounding, and it's hard to know what caused an acquittal in one case or a conviction in the other.
Yeah, and then some of those cases we'll never know. But if you're just joining us, L.A. County D.A. Robin Sachs is here, along with attorney Mark Worksman from Los Angeles, and we're talking about high-profile cases. I mentioned it briefly before, and we did a show on it last week, but there's a new network coming out called the Legal Edge Network, which will be going back to gavel-to-gavel coverage, mainly on the Internet, of trials, but the Internet seems to be the way of the future here now, and they'll be starting in September with Nevada versus Simpson, and I think that's about as high profile a case. It started with OJ on Court TV, and it's going to start again with the Legal Edge Network. Robin, your thoughts on cameras back in the courtroom full time with these sorts of cases?
Well, and that was actually going to be the next point that I made. There is a huge difference between observing what goes on in the courtroom and watching the court process, and having attorneys bring their clients, bring witnesses, bring victims in front of the camera to make their case. They're two very separate issues. They have very different goals. I think that the concern that happens, of course, with cameras in the courtroom in something like Court TV or the Leading Edge is that the players in the system, judge, attorneys, and everybody become sensitive to the media and maybe playing to the media and trying to create a persona. They may have other motives, other career goals, and so forth. And so they may not necessarily be acting in their client's best, you know, interest, whatever and whomever their client is, both prosecution and defense. However, having said that, I think that the interest and the public knowledge and the desire for this information is clearly there. And I find myself actually, you know, addicted to court TV on my Sirius radio in the morning because, you know, it's a way of escape. It's, you know, it's the real deal, and you can see how things play out, and you get a, you know, have kind of a twofold drama: one, the case itself, and two, you know, the inner workings of the system. And if you look at it as a tool to better the system, to educate the community, to, you know, perhaps deter crime or anything else, it could be a wonderful thing. I think the problem is, and it's like anything else, is that the things that attract the ratings are the things that are the bottom of the barrel, sex, juicy, drugs, and kind of the stuff that's really racy, and not the stuff that really makes the day in and day out stuff that goes on in courtrooms every day. Mark and I both are in courtrooms, and I sometimes, in the middle of very serious rape cases and sexual assault cases and murder cases, will turn around and not see one person in the audience. And there's, you know, a dead person that we're talking about.
Yep.
And yet there's no media coverage in that case, no family members in that case. And you have to say to yourself, why isn't the media concerned about the hundreds of empty courtrooms that exist across the country every day?
There's definitely a public craving for it, Mark. And, as a defense attorney, hypothetically, you're representing J.O. Simpson in a hypothetical high-profile case. Do you want the cameras in there or not?
No, I don't. I think the presence of the cameras distorts the proceedings. I think it causes judges and prosecutors to over-try a case at the plate of the public.
Yep.
It definitely lengthens the proceedings. Witnesses are afraid to come forward for fear that they're going to be on the news or they're going to be televised when they testify. I think it works a mischief into the system and warps it. So I discourage cameras. I don't mind. What we typically do in the Los Angeles courts is at the beginning of a case, at the beginning of a proceeding, the judge will entertain motions from the media to allow them to take pictures or to videotape the parties. And that's, I think, the public courtroom, the public has a right to see and know what's going on. But I don't think that they should be watching the gavel-to-gavel proceedings. Just as a lawyer for a defendant facing a televised trial, I would think that would stack the deck severely against getting a fair trial.
Well, there's some starstruck issues. You think of Judge Ito, and you think of the judge in the Anna Nicole hearing there, the crying judge, I forget his name now. And they all seem to be looking for their own either reality show or their own judge show. But can it not be helped a little bit to you have the camera stuck in your face to kind of act up a little bit so... You know, is that not a human nature a little bit, Robin, or am I acting up a little bit?
Well, you know what, to be honest, I think that, you know, for me, you get, and at least in the politics that are in our office and amongst your own colleagues, it is really tough to be on a high-profile case where you're in front of a camera because everybody has an opinion. You think all the talking heads have opinions, but all of... You know, my colleagues and Mark's colleagues and the defense bar and the judges. I mean, there is so many factors going on that I personally don't like it because I know in cases that, it's only a way for me to screw up somehow. In some way someone taking something I said out of context, a media clip that only is partial, commentating on top of my actual words, whatever the case may be. And if there's a good story in editing, the good story will be had. And so from my perspective, I think that, you know, in most of the situations, unless, you know, and under circumstances that Mark is saying, is in the pretrial motions and the arraignments and just to get kind of the video clip, you can satisfy the public knowledge and public interest. And you can still have the commentators and people who are interested could read, you know, daily transcripts that undoubtedly TMZ and all those people put up anyway on big cases. that should be enough to satiate the public.
Exactly, and the public seems to, I don't know, they seem to want more and more and more and more, but yet, Mark, we're hearing more lawsuits coming. This was released and shouldn't have been released, and this person suing this person, and I go back to the Hogan case, and I know that's not their real name, but Hulk Hogan's son, a minor in Florida custody, and his conversations with his parents, as weird as they were, being released to paparazzi press like TMZ, when in my opinion, yes, those recordings are there for a reason. I think safety issues and maybe some other issues, but selling them or giving them or leaking them or whatever to TMZ takes something away from that whole process, and it seems to sensationalize everything. Let's talk about that a little bit. Should that 17-year-old Nick Hogan be allowed at least the privacy of being able to talk to his parents on the phone without it being sold to the media?
He should be, and nobody should have their private conversations with family or with counsel intercepted and broadcast. But sometimes you live by the sword, you die by the sword.
Yeah.
Hulk Hogan and his family have craved public attention and sensational coverage of everything they do for decades. And so they've made themselves a magnet for tabloid coverage. And they can't just put the brakes on it and one day say, you know what, we want to be anonymous, private, dignified citizens, so please leave us alone, after they have courted public scrutiny for so many years. So you find this happening to people who bring it on themselves. If Hulk Hogan had been a quiet, unassuming private citizen, nobody would have cared what he and his son talked about.
Exactly.
If he was in a lockup.
Yep, you know, it's the old what goes around comes around, Robin. And how does that affect the credibility of the system itself? A lot of people, especially in your state, California, you know, say that the system sucks. You look at Blake, you look at Spector, you look at Simpson, and you look at others. I'm not asking you to comment on specific cases, but I'm asking you to comment on the public's trust of the system. And does that sort of stuff, like with Hogan and others, damage it?
Well, it certainly undermines the process, but I think Mark brings up an excellent point, is that, you know, you have the media interest because you're the, you know, when you're the folk, spend your career being in front of the camera or make a career of being a media person, you will, you know, inevitably, the best media story you can get is, you know, either you're having twins or you're in jail. So, you know, whether that's good publicity or not good publicity, in terms of the actual story, we do know that how it's handled can, you know, hopefully turns into good publicity. And if it's out there, the only way to possibly spin it, I think, from defense point of view, is to, you know, be able to have some coverage of it out there.
When you look at, you know, we've talked a lot about high-profile cases, cases in the media, Mark, that are out there, whether it's a celebrity or a you know, a beautiful lost little girl to a sports figure to whatever. But there's also Joe and Mary Public, Joe and Mary Sixpack, that are out there that, you know, are living their lives, and they have a faith or a non-faith in the system, yet they seem to think, and they seem to have this misconception, that the only way that they may be able to get an acquittal is if they had the money to do it. So why not take that plea bargain? Am I being a little bit facetious here, or is that some of the truth?
No, I often find clients absolutely overwhelmed and intimidated by a prosecution, and they will enter a plea bargain in order to avoid the cost or the trauma or the risk of a trial. I think there is a perception amongst many people that you really can't get a fair trial without having assembled a dream team, or without having tremendous public support, and just your average citizen who's facing a criminal prosecution is going to be sucked under by a riptide when they get to court. Now, that's a common perception. But then again, A lot of people who accept plea bargains and throw in the towel are guilty. I don't know that too many innocent people end up pleading guilty to crimes they didn't commit because they want to avoid what they perceive to be an unfair trial. I have a lot of clients who complain as they're accepting plea bargains that I'm only doing this because I feel like I have to. If I could, if I had the money, if I had the public profile, I'd fight this all the way to the end. They often say that, but they're rationalizing and they're trying to stay safe, save face, rather. So it's hard to know.
You know, I think what we need is a book. Let's see if I can remember Carnac, Johnny Carson. Let's see, maybe it was called The Complete Idiot's Guide to the Criminal Justice System. Let's say that book came out in April 2009. Robin, if you say you wrote that book, would that book explain the system a little bit to people?
Yes, my book coming out in 2009 does explain the system, and it.
Oh, it does! I'm shocked. I actually picked that up.
It's crazy.
Wow!
But it does highlight the pitfalls, and I think Mark brings up an excellent point. If prosecutors are doing their job and filing to the standard that we're supposed to file to, which that is not probable cause, not reasonable suspicion, if we can't convince ourselves beyond a reasonable doubt, the individual person, then we have no business filing the case. So we should be filing cases on guilty people. Everyone should be guilty when we're filing the case. Otherwise, we have no business filing the case to begin with. And as I try to explain to a lot of people out there is, the facts are the way the facts are. We get the cases however we get them. And our job is damage control and making sure that we, you know, have a good of a hearing and get a good of result as possible. And usually the most just result for both the victims and the defendant is a plea bargain, as well as for the system as a whole. When coming up with a plea bargain, we're looking for a resolution that's going to provide, you know, a hair better or a little bit better to make it worthwhile for the defendant to plead guilty. But we're going to get the plea, we're going to get the results, we're going to, you know, create the record and rap sheet. And if it works correctly, it's a win-win all around, because the defendant's getting a better deal than they would have gotten had we gone to trial and won, which is what should happen. And the victims and witnesses don't need to testify, and we're saving taxpayers money and unclogging the courtroom. And so it should be a good thing if it's done correctly.
You know, our final thought from Mark Worksman, an attorney from Los Angeles. It's a pretty good system we have, Mark. There's some problems. We could probably do a whole other show just on some of the problems that we have. But all in all, it's not a bad system representing everyone. What's the old saying, truth, justice in the American way, unless you're from Canada?
I think it's the best system that's ever been created by any civilized people. And if there were a better way to do it, I think we would have developed it by now. It's a system that really allows the citizens to decide through the jury system. And I'm always amazed at how reasonable juries are. I've convinced juries to acquit my clients. I've seen juries convict my clients. And I usually, and I think Robin will probably agree with me, although they can do crazy things. As Robin said earlier in the show, you have these people who are, some of them are quote, wing nuts, unquote. And they're selected randomly through the voter rolls and the motor vehicle rolls. But you take 12 people off the street who are adults and who will listen to the evidence, and you can't BS them. They'll figure things out, and they usually do the right thing. And I have a lot of faith in the system.
Absolutely.
I know there are some warps to it, and there are some problems. And principally, we discussed this during this show. They have to do with media coverage and public perception about certain people and things. But in general, I think it's a great system.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Rod, L.A. County D.A. Robin Sachs. Check out her webpage at www.robinsachs.com. And L.A. Defense Attorney Mark Worksman, thank you. And let's do this again real soon.
Thank you for having me. I look forward to it.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Good night.
I'm going to take a little break here, and I'm going to try something. I'm not sure if it's going to work or not. We'll either come back with another quick guest, or we'll come back and finish off the show. Regardless, you're listening to the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back.
It's the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. And now back to the show.
Okay, we're back. I want to thank my two guests this evening, Robin Sachs, L.A. County Deputy District Attorney, and Mark Wirksman, also from Los Angeles, who is a defense attorney. And we wanted to see if we could do a little bit more on the Kaylee Anthony story tonight, and I'd been working on it most of the day trying to get her grandmother to come on the program, but she hasn't been returning calls that I've made to her, but I do want to put your attention onto this website, www.helpfindkaylee is spelled Caylee.com. That's www.helpfindkaylee.com. Then you'll hear there about and see the story about Kaylee Marie Anthony. I'll read from the webpage. It says, "I'm almost 3 years old. I have shoulder length light brown hair. I have dark hazel brown green eyes. I have a birthmark on my left shoulder arm. I'm approximately 3 feet tall and weigh approximately 35 pounds. And this is in the Orlando, Florida area. This little girl is missing." It seems like the media have decided to focus, and maybe rightfully so, on the parent, the mother, who I also believe has a lot of answers, but we seem to be missing the fact and not advertising the fact enough that this little girl is missing and putting her picture out there. There's a tip line, 1-800-423-TIPS. That's 1-800-423-8477. And again, the webpage is www.helpfindkaylee.com. All right, that's it. That's tonight's show. I appreciate you all listening. Again, our webpage is at www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. There you can listen to the show live. You can listen to podcasts of past shows, my daily commentary, whatever. And of course, the show will be available on podcast a little bit later on this evening. I thank you all for listening and watching. Good night, and we'll see you again real soon here on the Dana Pretzer Show.
Been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.